Welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm your host, Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm here every Wednesday evening from 6 to 7 p.m. talking with authors, editors, agents, and poets about writing. Tonight I have with me in the studio two of my personal favorite mystery authors, Martin J. Smith and Philip Reed. Phil Reed began his writing career as a night police reporter for the City News Bureau of Chicago and continued as a crime reporter for the Rocky Mountain News in Denver, Colorado. In 1982, he moved to Los Angeles, where he directed his first play, True Blues. His plays have also been staged in San Francisco, Chicago, and New York. Phil's first car noir mystery, Bird Dog, was published in 1997 and was nominated for an Edgar and Anthony Award. A year later, Low Rider continued the story of hard luck hero Harold Dodge. Reed is also the author of several nonfiction books, including Candidly, Alan Funt, and Free Throw. Martin J. Smith is a veteran journalist and magazine editor. He's won more than 40 newspaper and magazine writing awards and four times was nominated by his newspaper for the Pulitzer Prize. His 15-year career as newspaper reporter took him around the world, and currently he's editor-at-large at Orange Coast Magazine. His Anthony Award-nominated first novel, Time Release, is in its third printing, and last year its sequel, Shadow Image, was published. Welcome, Marty and Phil.
Hi, Barbara. Thank you.
Glad you could both be here again. The last time you were here, in the summer, you were both about to undertake a book tour.
The Dad's
together.
Tour.
The Dad's Tour.
Yeah.
In November, the LA Times ran a story that you wrote about it. Mm-hmm. And for those who perhaps didn't catch the story, could you recount what happened, you did?
Well, it's a sad look into the realities of publishing in some ways. We had a great time, but the reality is that for writers like us, often the marketing of books comes down to kind of a one-man band. We decided to make it a two-man band after we realized we were both in the same situation with our second books coming out. Last summer, and decided to just sort of take our show on the road and go out and meet a lot of the booksellers in the West. We're both work-at-home fathers and you know, also faced the dilemma of what to do with the kids for the summer. And, you know, we put our heads together and realized that we could have a great time doing this and probably do our careers some good as well. So we rented a couple minivans and hit the road.
It was really the kids that made the story, though, don't you think, Marty?
Absolutely, and I made the trip, too.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, there was something about bringing the kids that sort of got everybody's sympathy going, don't you think, Marty? I mean, the first thing that everybody said was, you know, I can't be in my car with the kids for more than an hour, and you guys are going to go on the road for a month?
Yeah.
You know, are you crazy or what? But the interesting thing about it was that when you take a trip that's a little bit of vacation and a little bit of work, whatever's working, you can kind of, you know, claim a success.
Right.
So if you're having fun seeing the country, it's a vacation. If you're selling a lot of books, it's work.
Yeah, and you know, bottom line, we had a great time on the road with our kids. We saw a lot of the country, and we did sell a lot of books. Like I said, shortly after we got back, my first book went into a third printing, and I'm sure that was the result of all the work we did this summer. And you know, I just think, you know, it was a very easy decision. I'm kind of dying to do it again.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
my kids, they assume that we're going to do one every summer now.
How wonderful.
The kids got along with each other, which was another nice aspect to it.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I like the you said or what you wrote about having walkie-talkies in each van that you could talk back and forth.
Yeah, right. We got into some pretty remote areas. We went into this one area in northwestern Colorado, and there wasn't a single FM station within reach. Remember that?
Yeah.
The self-tuning on the van just kept going around and around. So we could still talk to each other on the radio.
That's right. Phil radioed me and said, do this. Do a scan on your radio dial and see what happens. And it just kept going up and down and nothing.
Yeah.
It didn't pick up a single signal. So, you know, there were, you know, those sort of shared moments in the desolate, you know, areas were kind of nice.
What was the highlight of the trip?
Well, we got to go to the inner reaches of Amazon.com, which is an actual physical place.
Yeah.
And we talked to Muffy and Tad and the people that run the place.
Yeah.
And hope they're not listening.
No.
Actually, Amazon.com has been very supportive, and it's interesting to see the show being run from the inside.
Mm-hmm.
We did a number of interesting things. One of the things that we added to our agenda were visits to the distribution warehouses of Ingram, which is the world's largest book distribution company, since bought out by Barnes & Noble. But to go and wander into these, 600,000, I guess they were 100,000 foot square foot warehouses with 600,000 to a million titles shelved and cataloged, ready to be shipped, and seeing your little book, sort of wedged in there with this huge amount of printed material was really sobering.
Yeah.
It was like the end of the Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Very much so.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that was a highlight, but it was a good chapter. It was a good thing to learn. So
I think really the highlight, though, was the San Francisco Bay Area.
Why so?
Oh, well, all of our events were the best there, wouldn't you say, Marty?
Yeah, there were actually people waiting for us, and the crowds were very receptive, and it's a very literate crowd up there, mm-hmm. so it was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. When your story ran in the Times mm-hmm. back in November?
November 1st, right.
Did anything happen as a result of the story?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of good feedback. For example, we're speaking next month at the Los Angeles County Sisters in Crime chapter mm-hmm. To talk about self-promotion and the need for writers to get out and market their books and support their books. It's led to a lot of speaking engagements and just a lot of nice feedback from writers who have been there. It's a very lonely idea, thinking that you're out there, you're not getting any support from your publisher or minimal support. And you think there's a tendency, I think, to take it personally.
Mm-hmm.
We're all in the same boat, mm-hmm. with very few exceptions. And, the feedback I ended up getting was from people saying, thanks for doing that, because, I'm going through the exact same thing, and it's nice to know that, it's nothing personal. Mm-hmm. It's just the way the industry works.
Mm-hmm. Now, do the two of you do these talks together? Have you become sort of a team in promoting your books?
Well, Phil, you want to
handle
that?
You're here together.
Marty says we're the Crosby and Bing Crosby and
Bob Hope,
yeah.
Now,
we're
who is who?
Well, next time we speak, we're going to wear cardigans and sit on stools, right, for the Sisters in Crime.
Right.
I'm not sure. We haven't gotten that far with our planning.
No, we spoke enough. I mean, we did about 35 bookstore events over the course of this summer, and we did a bunch of warm-up events before, and then mm-hmm. we've done a bunch of events since, and we've pretty much gotten sick of each other.
But we still keep learning new things about each other, wouldn't you say, Marty?
Oh, absolutely. I
mean, like?
Well, we were just talking just before we went on the air here about, I learned about this bicycle trip that Marty took around Europe back in like 78 or something. And I did a similar route several years before.
Interesting.
It seems like everything that Marty's done, I've done in some sort of different form.
We've and the two of you just met, not more than 2 years ago.
About a year and a half ago or something?
Yeah, we met in October 98. Or
yeah.
Yeah.
At VoucherCon at Monterey.
At a World Mystery Convention, and we were on a panel together mm-hmm. and sort of started, we had lunch and realized we had a lot in common, and, it's just continued. Ever since that date, we realized we have more in common than we thought.
Yeah.
This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm talking with Marty Smith and Philip Reed. How important are book tours, do you think, to the success of a book?
Well, there's a lot of mixed opinion about that. My attitude is that it can only help. And it's not that you go out and there's a crowd waiting for you at a bookstore. That very seldom happens for writers at our level. What more than likely happens is there's no crowd, and what you end up doing is getting to know the bookseller. Well, now there's the value,
mm-hmm.
because those are the people who, if they like your idea and they like the way you execute it and they like you, they're in a great position to put your book into the hands of people who were interested in that sort of thing. What you realize after you've done it for a while is it's a personal relationships business, and the fact is, booksellers tend to be very interesting people. They're really nice people, and they're very interesting, and they're interested in what you're doing. And, getting out and supporting your books that way, it's not the fantasy that a lot of writers have, adoring public waiting to hear you. It's more sort of selling books mm-hmm. and getting out there and meeting people and doing business that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's also nice to go out and talk to people that actually read books, and find out that there's a very active society of people who are reading and sharing ideas and sharing recommendations for the books that they've read. and they're very eager to meet you. And that's, I mean, as Marty pointed out, it's the crowds are underwhelming. But but when you do meet enthusiastic people, it makes it worthwhile.
There was going back to the idea of what the highlight of the trip for us was. I mean, there was this one moment where we were in Bellingham, Washington. I mean, the very northwesternmost mm-hmm. corner of the United States, as far from anywhere as you could get. And we went into this bookstore, and we sort of swarmed in with our children, and you know, we sort of overwhelmed this poor small town bookstore. And yet, you know, we go downstairs, and there was a guy who'd read Phil's first book, mm-hmm. and had come out to see him in Bellingham, Washington, a million miles from anywhere, and wanted to talk about it, and wanted to buy the second book. And it's just, you know, that's so gratifying to realize that, you know, sometimes this book publishing thing really does work. Mm-hmm. It does get into the hands of people who care about it. And that was fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, one of the things that's interesting about having a book published is that the book goes out into the world, and you can no longer control it. And people begin reading it in libraries. They read it. Friends lend it to other friends. And you just don't know where it's been and who's read it and how they've reacted to it. And when you meet somebody like that guy that I met up in Washington, you realize that what you're really doing is just it's just the tip of the iceberg. But I think in your mind you extrapolate it and sort of think about all the people that may have read it that haven't responded to it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, there's something very mysterious about it. And I think when you go on a book tour, it's not just about selling books. It's sort of about coming in contact with people who have read your books.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You were both reporters before turning to fiction.
Another similarity.
That's right, another similarity.
Yeah, we've from time to time talked about our police reporting days.
Mm-hmm. Did you always have it in you to write fiction back then when you were a journalist?
Well, I actually did the job in order to get a background to write with.
Really?
Because when I got out of college, I wanted to write, but I, you know, basically I had nothing to say. I really hadn't done a lot of living yet, and I wasn't going to write about high school or college. You know, there just wasn't very much there. And so I took the job to... I was just beginning to develop an interest in crime writing. When I was in high school and college, I read, you know, literature, but then I began to discover mysteries and crime, and I began to think, you know, this would be a perfect thing for me to write after 2 years on the streets in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. I didn't go into journalism with the idea of writing fiction. I mean, I was going to be a journalist all my life. But I think I got to the point in that career where I was writing the same stories over again. You know, mm-hmm. you know, there are only so many stories, and only the characters change. And, you know, I was writing the same stories over and over again, and I was kind of getting bored with it and started looking for ways to channel the sort of bigger stories that I'd stumbled across along the way. And that's how I got into this whole issue of memory and how memory is used in criminal justice. I was following a lot of cases as a reporter that really fascinated me, and the way memories were used and abused by prosecutors and defense attorneys and police really fascinated me. And so I started looking for ways to develop what began as a journalistic fascination, mm-hmm. you know, and sort of develop it into the fiction area. So it just sort of grew out of, you know, organically out of the stories I was covering, I think, as opposed to some master plan.
Mm-hmm. And your protagonist is a memory expert.
Correct. He's a psychologist who's an expert in the field of human memory, and is constantly sort of getting drawn into situations where you wouldn't think a psychologist would belong, but because he's uniquely qualified to work with people whose memory is either damaged or injured by disease or mm-hmm. accident, you know, he's uniquely qualified to help them recover and deal with memory issues.
Mm-hmm. And you, Phil,
yes.
Tell me about Harold. The only thing that Harold Dodge, your protagonist, seems to have in common with you is that you've written a few books on buying cars.
That's right.
Otherwise, so much in his life is falling apart, and everybody around him, their
yeah.
lives are falling apart.
You know, I'm really glad that you're saying all of this, Barbara, because other people have sort of come on to me with the opposite tack of, well, are you really Harold Dodge? And I'm not. I think that the reason that I wrote about Harold was because I felt that he was very, very different than me. And I've had kind of an aversion to, I mean, a lot of people seem to have to write about themselves, and I was the opposite extreme. I definitely didn't want to. What's interesting about it is that ultimately you wind up writing about the overlap between you and another person. Mm-hmm. You may think you're very different, but there's some sort of common ground there. that you may not even clearly identify, and you really don't have to. As long as it's working, that's what's important.
Mm-hmm. So what is it about the characters that are in Bird Dog and Low Rider that, you know, they're kind of marginal characters? Mm-hmm. What is it about them that interests you?
Well, I mean, this is kind of an indirect answer, but basically they're the kind of characters that after a lot of experimenting I find that I can write about, mm-hmm. and I'm not really sure why. When I sit down to write, they begin to talk. I think it may have to do with speech patterns. I like to listen to people talk. Like, I like to eat alone in a restaurant and overhear what people say. I used to be a playwright. And when you're writing a play, the only way you can reveal the character is by the way that they speak.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really a combination of a number of things. I decided to take as much of that as I could and put it into my books. And so through experimentation writing plays, I found that I write about this kind of character, sort of a driven character that's sort of sitting on top of a volcano, mm-hmm. emotionally, you know, and they're sort of trying desperately to hold things together. I wrote a play that was actually about the newspaper business called Nightside. It was a two-character play, and it had a character in there named Bernie Spurko. And Bernie Spurko's life was falling apart, and he was a real SOB. But I would sit and watch the play with people, with an audience, and first of all, they thought he was hilarious, which took me by surprise. And also, they really, really liked him. So there was something about a character who was just as nasty as could be that engaged their sympathies that really kind of began to fascinate me. So when I had the idea for Harold Dodge, I knew I could make that kind of a character work.
Mm-hmm.
So I was kind of homing in on my type of character.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Marty? How much is Jim Christensen you?
I like to say he's sort of, in some ways, a fantasy me. He's very tall. He's broad-shouldered, very athletic. And that's pretty much where the similarities end. He's an academic. He works at a university. He's a researcher. He does some therapy on the side, but he doesn't really enjoy it. What he really enjoys is trying to figure out how memories work and how the brain stores these little sort of electrical impulses and then is able to recall them, you know, based on some trigger. In that sense, he's sort of a different creature very much than me. He is a father. He's a very involved father.
Mm-hmm.
He's got kids. Two, one who's a college-age girl and another daughter who at this point is about 9 years old. I have a 10-year-old daughter and I have a 6-year-old son. I'm immersed daily in the issues of parenting and, you know, cooking macaroni and cheese and feeling guilty about that and all the things that a parent goes through, I've sort of given to him,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, I don't want him to be a sort of cool academic in an ivory tower. I want,
mm-hmm.
him to be a real person, and I want him to be dealing with real issues. And also, when you give somebody a couple of kids, that gives them a lot at stake, you
mm-hmm.
know, in books like these. So,
mm-hmm.
In that sense, I guess there are some similarities there, too.
Mm-hmm. Would you both describe the overall theme of your work?
Boy, that's a tough one. Marty, why don't you handle that one first? Let me think.
You know, I knew you were going to ask this, and I should have come up
with
something.
Well, actually, I have a pretty good idea of Bird Dog. I ask myself a lot about that. And I think the theme of that is how revenge eventually destroys the person who's trying to seek revenge,
mm-hmm.
because it's about a car deal gone wrong and a woman trying to get her car back, and she enlists Harold's help. And ultimately, she's nearly destroyed by the revenge that she's seeking.
Mm-hmm.
Again, mine go back to the issue of memory and how it works. And I guess, you know, the concept for sort of over the umbrella concept for all of these books is things aren't always what they seem. Memories exist in this blob of chemicals and electricity in our heads, and our criminal justice system tends to treat those things as solid ground. Well, they're anything but. They're like walking on smoke. There's not much to them. Memories begin to evolve from the moment something happens, and they're shaped by your perceptions and your biases and your past experiences. And so, you know, although we tend to rely on them and eyewitnesses as solid gold in criminal situations, it's anything but. And I've tried to use all of these books as a way of addressing the issue of, you know, wait a minute, you need to learn how to weigh this stuff against the reality of what memory is.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I've had a chance to think. Okay. So the other thing that I wanted to say was that I think both of my books are about how Harold has an idea of something that he wants to achieve, and he goes directly at that. And what he can't see is that he really wants something completely different. And I think that very often the reader can see that he's really after something completely different than his stated purpose. Mm-hmm. And in both books, they have kind of bizarre endings. They're not flat-out happy endings, which sort of drives my agent crazy, you know. But he gets really what he deserves at the end, which is neither good nor bad. Mm-hmm. It's something very unexpected, and I find that that's often the case in life.
He's a character that lands on his feet.
Yeah.
The end of the second book, I mean, how he could, I don't want to give it away, but he lands on his feet.
Yeah, well, that's the other thing that he can't see. He thinks everybody's picking on him, but he's actually a little bit smoother of an operator than he appears.
Interesting. Yeah. We're going to take a break. We'll be back in a few minutes with Marty and Phil, and they'll be reading from Works in Progress, so stay tuned. Don't go away, or go get some water or something and come back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
We are back. This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm talking with Philip Reed and Martin J. Smith. Let's begin with Phil. Tell us about what you're working on now, and then you're going to read us a couple pages.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm working on a book now, which is about horse racing.
Is this Harold?
No, this is not a continuation of the Harold Dodge thing.
How long are you going to make us wait?
That was one of the scary things about the tour last summer. People kept saying, well, what do you mean you're not working on another story about Harold Dodge?
Do you plan to do another book?
Yeah, I'd really like to. I'm kind of waiting for a publisher to ask me to, you know, frankly. But I thought, you know, I heard this story. This is based on a true story that happened to a friend of mine. And I actually went up to the Bay Area, and I met some horse trainers and some people involved in the racing community up there. And I thought to myself, well, this is a little bit like the Harold Dodge of the horse racing world, because it's a trainer who buys and sells horses. And there's lots of scams and tricks in the horse racing world. And this is really just a page. And after the earlier comments about Harold, I thought I'd read something that... first of all, I had some dialogue in it. I tend to like to write scenes that have a kind of a slice of life quality to them and have almost an elliptical sense to the language. But I also like to have a strong story. Now, this the main character in this story is a guy named Cliff Dante, who has a specialty in a practice called pinhooking, which is pinhooking. It means that he has the ability to spot a very promising horse at a young age, a horse that hasn't even been ridden. So by looking at a horse, he can tell that it's going to be a very fast racehorse that may make him lots and lots of money. And there are some fantastic stories about horses that they've bought for. Like, there was a horse that won the Derby that was they paid $17,000 for it. And after it wins the Derby, it's worth millions. So it's a highly speculative, highly risky business. And Dante's got a practice. And now, in the scene that I'm going to read, they're preparing for a race, and they're standing in the stall with the horse. And Dante's got an assistant named Emerson, who's a... I mean, people in the horse business, they just live to race. And I don't know if anybody's making any money. I mean, they'll even sleep in the tack rooms and horse trailers and so on, because they're so devoted to this world. Mm-hmm. And Emerson is kind of typical of that. Like I said, it's just a page.
Okay.
And but maybe it'll give you a little flavor of it. I'll head over to the grandstands now. But Cliff didn't move. He just stood there in the quiet stall on the backside of the track, a pigeon cooing in the eaves above, sunlight slanting in from a window high on the cinder block wall. He stroked Robohush's nose. The dark brown coat was as glossy as fine velvet. The colt was calm, very calm for a horse that could run like a dream. Cliff's eye moved over the horse's face and neck, his long back, his legs, thinking there might be something more to do to make him win. "I'll bring him over when I get the 20-minute call," Emerson said in his whispery voice, gray hair combed back, mustache neatly trimmed, watching the horse and watching his boss, too. "Better keep them wraps on till you get over to the paddock." Still stroking her nose, Cliff said, sure hope he brings it home today. We need the cash." "He's working large, Cliff. 22 and change. That's very large for a 2-year-old. Certain Victory's got the track record. Think he can beat that son of a gun?" Emerson thought it over carefully. Then he slowly whispered, "I don't know, Cliff, but he's been working very large." "Okay, then, I guess I'd better head on over." A high-tech tweedling noise came from somewhere, out of place in this stall with the smell of the earth and the animals heavy in the air. Cliff removed a small cell phone from the pocket of his navy blazer. He always wore the blazer for stakes races. He'd won a bunch of races in it, so he knew it was good luck, and he always wore it. Unless the purse was above 50 grand, then he wore the suit.
Thank you.
That's it.
Are you into horse racing?
I wasn't until I started writing this book.
How did you decide to write it about racing?
A friend of mine that I play golf with has a brother who lives up in San Francisco, and he has a lot of money, and he bought a horse race on a lark. And it brought him into this world that he had never known before. And the horse was stolen and taken to Europe, and he pursued it and recovered it and brought it back. And that's roughly what this book is about.
Mm-hmm.
So I went up, and he introduced me to the trainer that was involved. He introduced me. He took me to the backside of Bay Meadows, which is the main track up there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's basically my sort of source for all of the information that I have. But I've made numerous trips to the track myself,
mm-hmm.
and spent countless hours and money there.
Marty, mm-hmm. what are you working on?
I'm working on the third book in what's become this memory series, and... convicted. His nickname is the Scarecrow. He's a victim of fetal alcohol syndrome and is a very frightening looking person, accused of a very frightening crime, and yet the scientific evidence now suggests that he did not do it, which raises the question, well, if he didn't do it, who did? And they're still out there. The central character in this book is a woman named Teresa Harnett. She's a former police officer, and she is the one who gave this eyewitness testimony that said, pointed to this gentleman in the courtroom and said, "That's the guy who did this to me, and I remember every detail of it, the sights, the sounds, the smells." Here she is 8 years later, and she's been proven wrong by science. And that sends her into a tailspin, because all of a sudden it gives her license to start questioning her own memories of what she remembers and how those memories became so vivid and yet so wrong. And what I'm going to read is the prologue to the book, which is when you meet Teresa Harnett and you start to see her having these doubts.
Okay.
It's about 3 pages long. It's not long at all.
Great.
Teresa heard the voice again, deep and familiar, a menacing whisper jolting her from a restless sleep. You never rose. The words shot through her like an electric current, surfacing from somewhere dark and deep. She was shaking, her knees pulled up against her t-shirt, clinging to her chest and her back. You never rose. Whose voice? Not his. Damn, not his. The thought triggered a sudden sob, and she covered her mouth with her hands so she wouldn't wake David again. She looked over at the mountain rising under the blanket, hoping she'd caught her cry in time. His face was turned away. She listened for his breathing, held her own breath as she did. You're dreaming again, Therese, David said. She found her voice. I know, I'm sorry. Need a pill? No, I'm okay. You sure? I'll get you a pill. I don't want a pill. She threw back the damp sheets and dangled her legs off the bed, listening to her blood pulse. She closed her eyes, but the face was still there, always there. That unforgettable face, the stuff of nightmares, her nightmares. But something was different. The mouth still moved behind the ski mask, but the voice was different, deeper. Whose? In the dark bathroom, she lifted handfuls of hot water to her reconstructed face. It soaked the dark hair that hid the surgical scars along her scalp. It pasted her bangs to a forehead cross-hatched by the fading lines of long-ago incisions. Her face steamed from the water, but she still couldn't stop shivering. She pulled off her terry robe from the back of the bathroom door and put it on, drawing the belt tight around her narrow waist. When that didn't stop the chill, she wrapped herself in their bath towels, one around her shoulders and one around her legs. One of the towels swept across the countertop as she lurched toward the light, knocking the plastic jar of aloe gel into the sink. It bounced and clattered and finally rolled to a stop against the drain as she shut the door. She closed her eyes against the harsh light and groped back to the toilet, where she sat quaking, trying to make some sense of the voice. Not his, but whose. You okay? David called. Fine, she said. I'll be fine. When she opened her eyes, the walls began to expand and contract, like the bathroom itself was breathing. Its corners disappeared. Shapes shifted, colors transformed. Everything started to move. She gagged once, then leaned over and vomited into the bathtub. She retched as the smell rose, then vomited again as she reached for the tap. A rush of cold water washed the worst of it away. He knocked lightly. Therese? She couldn't answer, just heaved again. The bathroom shook with her strangled howl. You need help, Annette? She clutched the sides of the tub, wiped her mouth on the towel around her shoulders. The worst was over, so she turned off the water. No, just, I'll be okay. Don't come in. You sick or dreaming again? Must be sick, she lied. Need anything? Privacy, she thought. Just go back to bed, okay? I can handle it. You let me know if you need anything. Pepto? She retched again, but nothing came up. Some toast? He asked. She turned on the water, letting its rush drown out David's good intentions. It spilled onto the tub floor, then began its search for a way out. She knew the feeling. So easy for water in a tub, only one place to go. But what about her? What to do with these doubts after 8 dead certain years? She turned off the tap, gathered the towel regally around her shoulders, and stood swaying before the mirror like some prom queen from hell. Her face was familiar, but a storm raged behind her eyes. She felt the ground beneath her shifting, eroding everything she knew, everything she swore had happened that night. These things she was remembering no longer fit a version of reality that seemed as carefully rebuilt as the face in the mirror. Something unthinkable was pulling her down, and she was whirling closer and closer to some dark truth. For her, though, there was no easy way out.
Thank you. You know, Marty, you're the king of outlining, at least for your first book. I think we talked about this the last time you were on, that you spent something like, 6 months or so outlining this book before you began writing it, your first book, Time Release?
Actually, Time Release was a good 2 years in the outlining stages. I mean, working on the synopsis, kind of working out the bugs in the story. I like to think I've gotten a little bit faster at it, but, you know, the bulk of the blood, sweat, and tears that I put into a book is done at that stage where I'm really kind of working out the story and making sure that everybody's motivations are right and the right characters are playing the right roles and the plot is plausible. You know, the fun part of the writing is actually taking that bare-bones outline, that synopsis, and dramatizing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I, like I said, I've gotten a little bit better at it. This one probably took me about 4 months to conceive, and then I've actually, now that I'm writing full time, took me about 4 months to write.
Mm-hmm.
So,
wow. This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco-Berra talking with Philip Reed and Marty Smith on writers on writing. Phil, what is your writing process like? Do you do a lot of outlining and plotting before you set to work?
I do everything that I can, but I lose patience with it, and I want to jump in and start really doing the actual words on the page. I envy Marty. I'd like to be able to do an outline, but I can't conceptualize a story that way, I don't think. I kind of go back and forth between outlining and writing, because I think up front you can have an idea, or I can have an idea of what a character might be like, but then when you start writing it, it may turn into something very different. Mm-hmm. Other characters don't pan out. You know, you think it's going to be a sensational character, and on the page it turns out to be flat. Mm-hmm. So then you need to change course. Mm-hmm. And what I do a lot of is writing down notes on 3x5 index cards, like Carol Dodge. He does his best thinking on a 3x5 index card.
And so you are like him.
Yeah, right. Yeah, actually, that's sort of a screenwriter's trick. You know, they always tell you to write down the names of or a short description of every scene on an index card, and then you can pursue the story in a non-linear sense. And so I accumulate lots of these cards until I feel sort of comfortable that I've got something in the bank, and then I start writing. Mm-hmm. And whenever I run out of someplace to go next, I look at my cards and see if there's something there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of a rough idea of how I move. I think it is a really good idea to outline as much as possible, because I've seen so many writers begin a story with a promising beginning, and then they just peter out. Mm-hmm. And it's not because the story was no good. It was because they wrote to the end of their energy and then had no place to go and became discouraged.
Hmm.
So, yeah, I think that the outlining is a good thing to do.
Talk about using multiple points of view. I know in your books you have quite a few points of view characters. And as I recall, in the last one, I think there were three point of view characters. What's the advantage of multiple point of view novels?
For me, it was a big discovery. It was a tremendous discovery. Because I think there's a certain energy which is generated when you jump from one person's point of view to a different person's point of view. First of all, there's a slight element of mystery to it, because it takes the reader a second to sort of kind of get on board and say, what's going on here? You know, what is this? And I've noticed when I read screenplays or books that are told that way, I have a great rise in interest every time that happens.
Mm-hmm.
I also enjoy writing different characters, and I like having a different sound to the writing when you're writing a different point of view. Also, it's interesting because you can sometimes go back over the same material and show it from a different point and bring out different elements to it. Because in this life that we're leading, you know, we always imagine what the other person may be thinking, but we have no idea really what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And a book is a chance to find out what that's like.
Mm-hmm.
You're right. I think I tend to go between 3 and 5 points of view in a story. And I think my characters have to sort of win the right to have their point of view in there. They have to be interesting enough for me to want to get inside their head. And they're not just role players in this drama. They are people that you want to introduce the reader to more fully. It's complicated by the fact that I've got this main character, Jim Christensen, this memory expert, but he's also sort of a 90s guy, and he's involved in a very equal relationship with a very powerful woman. So to sort of, you know, I want that to be an equal relationship, and therefore their points of view have to be roughly equal. Otherwise, he becomes the hero, and mm-hmm. she becomes the supporting actress, and mm-hmm. I didn't want it to feel like that. With the third book, Straw Man, that I'm working on now, I went nuts. For the first time, I've written the bad guy's point of view, which was kind of a whole new experience for me. I hope it works. I don't know that it will, but I hope it does. Mm-hmm. And it's fun to kind of experiment with that. I've really enjoyed it. I agree with Phil. I think readers respond very positively every time that the point of view shifts.
Well, also it's a wonderful, I don't know, device for increasing suspense, because just when something's happening, you cut to another point of view, and how can you put the book down?
Right.
Yeah, it seems to be, it's as corny as it seems, you take them up to a point of interest, And then just before you're about to give them the payoff, you cut to something else, and it drives people crazy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know that it's funny how it can even be kind of an obvious ploy, and yet it works very well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you see it happening all the time, particularly like I think I was telling you about it in Goosebumps, mm-hmm. the Goosebumps books. My son, who's 12, said he figured out that every chapter opens with the line, "He opened the door and screamed," and then the chapter ends. And when he told me that, I laughed and then secretly went back and thought, yeah, that's right, I'll use that, you know.
Okay, so.
Yeah.
What else about writing suspense? What's the key to writing good suspense?
Well, I think, you know, this kind of goes back to playwriting, too, but in playwriting, they talk an awful lot about subtext. And also going back a little bit to Harold Dodge, you know, he's saying one thing, and yet under the surface something very different is happening. That creates kind of a tension between the intentions and you know, what's really going to happen. And I think that if you make a commitment to that, it can be a really powerful tool in the book. Because I think, I know that when I talk to people, I'm always filtering, you know, is this person putting me on? You know, are they lying or are they exaggerating? You know, you're playing that whole game. Well, if you can do that in a book, and you can, I mean, like, it's fun to see people lie in a book, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that what we love to do is guess about people's intentions based on very small signals, you know, from the outside.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I actually have learned a lot from talking to actors. I directed one of my plays. And, you know, there's this thing where they talk about how, you know, they play the same scene, except, you know, the man who just walks on stage has just murdered his wife. But the scene has nothing to do with murdering anybody, you know, but how would that change their behavior?
Mm-hmm.
You know, change it radically.
Mm-hmm.
And so actors are doing that all the time. I think writers get to do it too, don't you, Marty?
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. One of the things about suspense that I learned early on, because I have my agent turned into a wonderful mentor for me, and, you know, the advice she gave me early on is, you know, in the reader's mind, the clock has to be ticking from the very first page, you know, and they have to understand what the stakes are, and they have to understand, you know, what could possibly go bad here, and they go into that book expecting that,
mm-hmm.
you know, when is the payoff going to come? And the more you can sort of tease the reader along with that ticking clock, you know, keeping them aware that, that time is going out, there's a deadline approaching, that something's going to have to happen, and if it happens right, it goes well. If it doesn't, it's going to go wrong. You know, there's a real sort of art to that that I wouldn't pretend to be a master at, but, you know, the people that I read who I think are keep that ticking clock in the reader's mind constantly. You know, I'm probably kind of clumsy about it. I actually, you know, have people looking at clocks all the time, and I hear, you know, when the stove turns on and the gas lighter, it goes tick, 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 you know, and I sort of plant these little seeds in there to kind of keep the idea that there's a clock running,
mm-hmm.
but I do think that's in the genre of suspense, that's the primary thing you have to keep in mind.
Were you going to say something else?
Well, I was just, Marty brought up the word teasing, you know, and I think that that's not a bad way to approach it. I think, I know that I enjoy being teased, you know. I guess being teased by a mystery, you know, it's the thing that we can't see that we want to know. I've been so disappointed by so many books when I get to the ending, you know, but up to that point when you're in that state of guessing, I think that's the most fun part of reading
mm-hmm.
a book, and it's certainly if you can do that. And that actually brings up something different. I mean, one of the difficulties with writing a book is that you can never really be surprised. I mean, maybe you can be surprised once when you have the idea.
Mm-hmm.
But when you go back and read your book, you know, how can you be surprised? You know who did it, you know? So but that's a whole other process of trying to review your material mm-hmm. and see if it's working.
How about dialogue? Because you both write wonderful dialogue. What can you say about that? I mean, you had mentioned going out and you like to sometimes have meals alone to observe. Mm. Is that how you hear dialogue? Or?
Yeah, dialogue's probably one of those things that you can't really teach very directly. And what works in real life doesn't necessarily work on the page.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if you tape recorded a conversation and then transcribed it, it would feel very different than what you read in most books, and particularly see in movies and hear on television. So I think it's a long process of experimentation, you know, what works for you, what does your ear tell you. I think that I had a job once where I worked for an investigator, and I transcribed actual testimony of interviews with accident victims, and it was a really good process. because even within that clunky framework, it could be really a fascinating study. I knew nothing of the characters. I only heard a voice on a tape recorder. And yet I was constantly trying to guess, what did they look like? What did they really mean? And that whole thing about whether they're lying. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm kind of fixated on lying. I should have been a cop, I think.
I thought you were a cop.
No.
When I first met you.
Really?
I thought you were a cop.
It was the uniform. You know,
I got to put that uniform away. That could get me in trouble.
I think it was a Left Coast crime, and you were on a panel, and I was certain you were a cop sitting there.
How should I take that?
It's not a bad thing.
I think, I got a lot of education in dialogue writing by doing plays and hearing actors. Mm-hmm. One of the things that you really learn is that the simplest lines with an interesting reading can, first of all, be very funny. You know, because there's so many different inflections they can give to a simple word. Right. And they were always discovering things that you didn't even know were in there, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. But that's not something that everybody has an access to. The other thing is writers should do is just read their own material out loud and see if it sounds good. Mm-hmm. If people run from the room covering their ears, they should rethink what they're doing.
Right. Mm-hmm. I don't have any great philosophy of writing dialogue other than what somebody told me early on, and that was it should always work at angles to it itself. In other words, it should never be question-answer. It should go at angles to itself. It should be, hey, how you doing? Nice shirt, you know, kind of. And that gives it a sort of a dynamic quality that even if it's utilitarian and it's simply there to sort of establish a plot point or whatever, it can be entertaining and it can be, you know, energetic, and it doesn't have to be straight across the table, two people talking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think dialogue should ever be direct. Mm-mm. I mean, if it's just two people conveying information, which is literally true, what's the point?
Right.
You know, you could have described that in some other way.
Right.
There has to be some greater purpose to it.
Mm-hmm. Jim Christensen, Straw Man will be the third book with him. Did you intend to write a series character when you began, when you first wrote Time Release?
I didn't. I just sort of stumbled across a plot that I thought was kind of interesting, and I got to the end of that. The first Time Release dealt with the issue of memory repression and the whole phenomenon of people taking recovered memories out of their therapist's office and trying to prosecute cases with them. I got to the end of writing that in 1994, and that was right around the time Ronald Reagan was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease and announced that. And here I just finished a book with a memory expert, and I had an idea for a plot involving a very powerful individual who whose memories suddenly were untrustworthy and was remembering things that a lot of people thought that maybe were best kept secrets. And so I created a character that mirrored that dilemma, and suddenly I had a series. I think by the time I got to the end of writing Shadow Image, which was the second book, I really had clarified in my own mind what I was trying to say about memories, and that is, look out for these things. Mm. They're dangerous, and yet we rely on them. And that's how Straw Man was born. And right now I'm planning on it being a trilogy. I'll probably come back to it at some point in the future because I've met, you know, I've introduced a lot of characters along the way that I'd like to develop as main characters in future books. But for right now, I think I'm going to end it at three and then try something different for the next book.
Okay. We have another minute or so. Any advice or words of wisdom for our listeners?
Well, what I always try to tell people is write quickly and then edit carefully. That was a big discovery to me with those exercises of speed writing, and I still do that. I can write 4 pages in an hour, and then I have the rest of the day to myself. So that's my, don't sit there and excruciate over every word, just kind of get the guts down.
Mm-hmm. Right, I agree. And persistence is, we've all been in the same position that I think a lot of people out there are, and that is writing something that you believe in and not having anybody affirm that. No, not an agent, not a publisher. You know, in the beginning, very often it's a very long and lonely road. We've all traveled it, you know, and we're, you know, living proof that, you know, if you're persistent and you keep after it and you sit down and write every day, you know, as they say, the only difference between writers and aspiring writers is that writers write. Write, you know, there's no getting around that. And be persistent about it and pursue it.
Well, I remember when I met you, you were, you know, editor of Orange Coast, and you were getting up at 4 in the morning to work on time release.
Yeah, I've often said...
was very impressive.
Yeah, I've often said you don't find the time to write that novel, you make the time. Mm-hmm. You make the time depending on your level of commitment. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, I thank you guys for being here.
Well, thank you for having us.
Yes,
it's wonderful to have you again, and the time sped by, as it always seems to. But you'll come back when your books come out.
Well, I hope we can come back sooner.
Okay, really. You can.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Again, Marty Smith's books are Time Release and Shadow Image, and Philip Reed's novels are Bird Dog and Low Rider. They're great reads and great studies in structure. If you have any comments about Writers on Writing, email me at bdemarcob@aol.com. And if you know anyone who'd like to listen to my show or any show here on KUCI and they have internet access, the address is www.kuci.org. I'll be here next week from 6 to 7 with mystery author Barbara Serinella. The music you heard during the show is by Brian Barrett. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, again at KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Chris is on next with music for Lunch Pails. Take care, and thank you for listening. Now, get to work. Remember, it's all about writing like there's no tomorrow.